podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was originally featured as a video on the IEA London YouTube channel, but we've taken the audio and turned it into a podcast so that you can listen on the go. Enjoy.
Boom shakalaka, we're back for another episode of Live with Littlewood in our new magnificent studio with a live audience. Coming up on tonight's show, the Northern Ireland Protocol. What's going to happen there? And our energy woes, how do we get out of the energy crisis? And what are we going to do to make sure that we don't repeat the mistakes of COVID when the next pandemic hits? So, three pretty easy questions for my stellar panel of guests to sort out, all coming up in the next hour. Kaboom, kapow, welcome, welcome, welcome to tonight's episode of Live with Littlewood. This is our 50th episode of Live with Littlewood. That's right, we've notched up a full half century. So thanks to the hundreds of thousands who have watched us and the many, many dozens of guests who've joined us as well. If you've enjoyed the show, if you're watching tonight, remember to hit the like button below, the subscribe button and the notification bell so you never miss an episode in future or indeed any of the other great content on the IEA London YouTube channel. If in these difficult times you've got a few pennies or a few pounds spare, then also consider becoming an IEA online patron. You can see details in the chat and in the show notes below about how to become an IEA online patron. We're back for our second Live with Littlewood, live in front of a live studio audience. A number have asked how you can join the live studio audience, not just to see the show here in Westminster, but to join us for a post-match chat as well. Well, the first invites will be going out to our online patrons, so do consider becoming one of those. Later in the show, I'm going to be joined by Henry Hill to discuss the risks and opportunities facing the Union of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Our very own Victoria Hewson, Head of Regulatory Affairs here at the IEA, will be considering what's snarling up our supply chains at the moment. And I'll also be warmly welcoming back to the show Jamie White, the IEA's former academic and research director, author, commentator, and he's going to be telling us a little about what he thinks of what we've learned over COVID and how we make sure that we don't fight the last war when the next pandemic hits. But first up, I'm delighted to welcome a good friend and very, very special guest, the former Northern Ireland First Minister, the Right Honourable Arlene Foster. How are you, Arlene?
I'm
lovely
good.
To see you.
Nice
lovely to see you. So, what a great day to have you on. We're calling this section Frosty Relations, the Northern Ireland Protocol. The EU, I am told today, has announced, quote, their quote, very far-reaching proposals for reforms to the protocol, fewer checks on goods travelling from GB to Northern Ireland, an apparent victory in the sausage war for the UK, a new arrangement to allow the continued sale of chilled meats in Northern Ireland. How very far-reaching are these proposals, and are you wholly satisfied with them?
Well, I think you know me well enough to know that I'll not be wholly satisfied, Mark. But, you know, I think you've read out the EU strapline there, and it's about fewer checks, which inevitably means there will be some checks. And I think that is the point. But look, I don't think there's any doubt that there has been a lot of movement in what has been proposed. I've just skimmed through what they've said. I think it only came out at 5:30 there. And it brings me back, actually, fond memories of 2018, 2019, when we talked about maximum facilitation. You'll remember that, mm-hmm, max fax, mm-hmm, as it was then. So doing checks, which meant that you would have a Northern Ireland channel, in other words, things that were only going to Northern Ireland and therefore weren't at risk of going into the single market, mm-hmm, and then another channel for goods that were going into the Republic of Ireland. And technical, using data, using intelligence. Of course, that was all dismissed as being unicorn suggestions, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, at the time. You'll
and
remember
now it's
that.
A necessity.
And now it's somehow a solution. But look, let's not be churlish about that. I think there has been movement in that respect. Of course, this all could have been prevented from happening. We warned the Prime Minister at the time that this was the likely outcome. What I don't see in what the European Union has put forward, Mark, is anything about VAT. And what I don't see is anything about the European Court of Justice. And I think it's very clear that they're going to fight David Frost on that issue.
And just explain to us why, each in turn, why are those important? What is the VAT issue?
Well,
what
the VAT issue, we are in the UK VAT territory, if you like, but we have to apply EU VAT rules. So we're in the, it seems a bit strange, I'm sure, for some of your viewers to understand that, and it's very difficult to apply. And if there is a particular problem for people who are buying and selling, for example, secondhand cars from, and there's a very strong secondhand car market from Great Britain into the Republic of Ireland, then they're being hit by double VAT. They're being hit by UK VAT and European VAT as well. So there needs to be a solution found in relation to that. And then, of course, the European Court of Justice is the big one. It's the sovereignty one. And normally when you have a trade arrangement between two sovereign bodies, you have an arbitration and an independent body decides what happens in relation to the problem.
Yeah,
of course, what we have is the ECJ.
Well, I can't get my head around that at all. This would be like a football match where if there's a controversial decision, you ask the Southampton manager to adjudicate rather than to ask the referee to adjudicate,
correct,
right? So, I mean, that should never have been there in the first place. But the EU are giving no room on either of those so far.
No.
Okay. So, this takes us to Article 16.
Yeah.
To have followed UK politics over the last few years, you just need to read lots of articles, right? Article 50. Now, Article 16. So, this is about the Union, the European Union, or the UK, taking unilateral action and safeguarding measures. And it says we can act unilaterally if the application of the present protocol leads to, quote, serious economic, societal or environmental difficulties that are liable to persist, you might argue those have happened, or, this is the key part for me, to diversion of trade.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an open and shut case, isn't it?
Well, it is an open and shut case. And the command paper that the government published in July, where they said, here's what we need to see changed. And actually, I'm a little surprised, Mark, when I hear some commentators, and particularly Irish government ministers, saying that this whole issue about the European Court of Justice is out of the blue. No, it's not. It's in the command paper. Mm-hmm. It's there to be read. But in that command paper, our government recognised and accepted that the conditions for Article 16 to be triggered were there.
Mm-hmm.
They could do it, and they had justification for doing it. But what they wanted to do was to try and find a consensual way forward. Now, of course, I would have preferred if they triggered Article 16 to stop the ongoing economic difficulties. But in a way, I can understand the government wanted to find a negotiated settlement, and that's what they've been trying to do.
So, on the protocol, you and I have discussed this before, but you obviously also launched a High Court challenge to the protocol. The case was thrown out in June on the basis that an Act of Parliament, the Act of Parliament that passed the withdrawal bill, sort of overrides the Act of Union. You know, successive parliamentary acts overrule it. So the Act of Union essentially was not given special constitutional status. I mean, we'll come in a few minutes to whether the UK government might actually trigger the protocol, but is there still a legal route or does that shut it down?
Oh, no, it's still there. And we're in the Northern Ireland Court of Appeal just this week, actually, with the appeal case. The Lord Chief Justice indicated that because there were ongoing negotiations, she pushed it back to see where those negotiations would lead us to. But we were arguing that actually the Withdrawal Act had changed the Act of Union, and that's a constitutional, that's one of the founding documents actually of our constitution, and the article that we were talking about in that was Article 6, which promises unfettered trade between the different parts of the UK, and of course that was promised in the Internal Market Bill as well, that we would be able to trade openly and freely within the internal market of the UK.
So the legal route is still possibly
open.
What's your read of the political route? Do you think the UK government, David Frost, will say, sorry, this just isn't good enough. I don't know what piece of paper he needs to sign or what he needs to stamp, but to say, there you go, Article 16 is triggered by us.
Well, I mean, the conditions are there to trigger Article 16. I think he probably would prefer to find a negotiated way through. I do accept that the European Union has moved and moved significantly. I accept that totally. But there are still issues that need to be ironed out, and presumably they will now enter into a period of negotiation. But some of the offside sounds from the Irish government in particular have been very harsh indeed. We've heard from Leo Varadkar, we've heard from the former Irish ambassador to the United Kingdom. You know, some of their comments have been really out of order. You can't trust the Brits, essentially, right. You know, and all of this sort of thing, really dragging. I actually believe that Anglo-Irish relations are at a really low ebb, probably as low as I can remember them, and I've been living through the Troubles, Mark.
Yeah.
So it's pretty bad.
So that does sound great. But are you confident that a solution is within grasp now? You said, well, the EU have moved a lot. You're not totally satisfied with it, but that's obviously a movement in the right direction. It looks like the UK government, we can argue about how the hell they got themselves into this mess, but
are
trying to, you know, I mean, David Frost is at least talking a good game. Can you see this all being wrapped up and solved in the next, I don't know, few weeks or months?
Well, it needs to be. And I have to say there has been a complete change of pace since David Frost became involved in these negotiations. And I do think he has raised the game as regards the UK government. People are taking him seriously. We were told the protocol can't be reopened. That's what it is. Just get on with it. He has reopened it. There are now these proposals on the table which need to be negotiated out. People have to, in Europe, understand, and I thought this was very interesting in Frost's speech yesterday in Lisbon, where he was very clear. Northern Ireland's part of the United Kingdom. It's our job to look after Northern Ireland, not the European Union's job to look after Northern Ireland. Actually, what we're doing is helping protect your single market in the European Union by agreeing to do all of these things. So, actually, try and work with us on all of this. I thought his statement was very, very clear on the sovereignty issue, but we'll wait and see what happens in the next couple of days. But at least now we know that the protocol can be reopened. And of course, the protocol itself, Mark, says that it can be reopened because it envisages subsequent agreements. If you look at it, I think it's Article 13.8, if people want to have a wee look at that.
Right, 13.8, another article I've got to swat up on and memorise. Tell our viewers and listeners a bit, Arlene, on what's been the real impact on the ground in Northern Ireland of the application of the protocol. You mentioned complexities around VAT on selling second-hand cars. What else is actually happening, you know, on the high street, in the supermarket, to business? What's been the pain that the average Northern Irish person's felt so far?
Well, look, when we warned about the difficulties with the protocol, and when it came into being in January of this year, look, it's in being, we'll have to try and make it work. And I said that publicly, and I sometimes get berated for saying, what's the difference between now and then? Actually, I was trying to make the protocol work, but it became clear very quickly that it was causing economic damage. So we had tariffs on steel, for example. We tried to sort that out, and we were trying to pick things off as they came along, but actually it became impossible. It became impossible. So we were having a reduction in choice, and we were told that the cost would increase as well. GB suppliers were saying to some of our small businesses, it's not worth our while sending goods to Northern Ireland because it's too complicated, it costs us too much. Some of our companies were having to employ people just to do the paperwork associated with GB to Northern Ireland in terms of their supply chain. And that shouldn't be the case.
And that makes a lot of businesses unviable, right?
The whole point about Brexit was that we were going to lessen the numbers of regulations and bureaucracy. And actually, what we found is that for Northern Ireland companies, they're having to do more.
Okay. Well, I think you've navigated us a fair way through how we need to try and solve this problem. But to help us just get over the line, delighted to be joined by our next guest. So, Arlene, stay with us while we welcome Henry Hill, news editor of Conservative Home. Henry, great to have you with us. Have a seat. Lovely to see you. So, Henry, what's your take on this? Do you think that these new EU proposals get us towards a negotiated settlement, or is your take that if the so-called Conservative and Unionist government is actually going to act in a Unionist fashion, it has to trigger Article 16, really?
I mean, I think that's sort of a false choice, because Article 16 is not a panacea. Mm. What I think a lot of people need to understand is that Article 16 does not end the protocol. It suspends parts of it for a given amount of time and creates an environment in which you can try and negotiate a new settlement, but it's not simply aborting the protocol. I think that the movement is good because it discredits this idea that we heard from a lot of commentators that the protocol was simply an inevitable consequence of Brexit, and that this was, you know, the best of all possible worlds, even if it wasn't particularly good. The EU has now conceded that movement is possible, and I think the government will now probably press for them and say, right, if this is possible, then surely more movement is possible. Arlene's right that it doesn't do anything about the European Court of Justice, which I think is still the big one and has been the big one since the beginning. You know, there's some very good articles out there basically explaining that this is an extraordinary imposition for any 21st century body to put on what is supposed to be a sovereign state with which it's seeking friendly relations. It's a very 19th century. You know, we did this to China at one point in the 19th century. I think it's sort of slightly strange that the European Union thinks it should be doing it to us. So the government does need to go further, but the challenge for the government is, one, what's its actual end game here? Because the EU has moved, and David Frost, instead of has used the space to create a bit more distance by emphasising the ECJ point, which suggests that the government hasn't got where it wants to go. But where does it want to go? I don't have a clear idea so far of how far they're going to push this, because if they do want to get movement on the ECJ, that's going to be extraordinarily difficult. And then the other question is, does Boris Johnson really have the willpower to push this row as far as it can go, given the importance of trade with the European Union?
Yeah, okay. Well, Arlene, you sort of mentioned that Anglo-Irish relations are pretty frosty at the moment. I don't really want to compare them to North and South Korea. I don't think it's as bad as that. But North and South Korea, of course, have this armistice, but have never actually agreed peace. Is there a danger, if we trigger Article 16 and just keep sort of repeating it, that we're actually just in a sort of twilight zone, no man's land, that we've never really resolved it and are just sort of rolling over a suboptimal second best solution of just continually hitting the Article 16 button?
Well, you know, we were sort of in that area when we kept having grace period after grace period, you know, lengthened again and again. So at least David Frost has brought forward an alternative protocol, as I understand it. He has presented a new legal text. The European Union has come forward with these four papers in areas that they are saying that they can foresee movement. I suppose now, when the rubber hits the road, it's what happens next in terms of all of this. Boris, the Prime Minister has indicated that he does want to get this sorted out. I mean, when I go back to October 2019, 2 years ago, and think about how we were pleading with him not to do the protocol, and please, it's going to cause no end of difficulties. But he decided to go ahead because he wanted to get Brexit done. And I don't think we should forget the pressure that was on at that time and the way in which Parliament was behaving, and there was a need for him to deliver on Brexit. And I accept that. From a Northern Ireland point of view, it was a betrayal, actually, in terms of we wanted Brexit as well, but we weren't delivered Brexit. And therefore, he feels, I think, quite strongly that he wants to get it sorted out, but we'll see what that material, what the material way in which that comes forward.
Henry, having spent what feels like the best part of a decade arguing about Brexit here and our relationship and finally getting it over the line, are we now in for years of introspective constitutional wrangling over the position of Northern Ireland in the Union, over the position of Scotland in the Union? Are we now just going to be in a permanent kind of constitutional cycle of, you know, introspection?
Hopefully not permanent. But Brexit has certainly thrown up a lot of questions which badly need answering. I think Northern Ireland, if we treat Northern Ireland as a separate case for a minute, I think the big one that has been a can of worms that's been opened up by Brexit on the mainland is the question of these post-EU powers and the row over those, because there was, you know, the British position originally was that they'd been given to the European Union by the British government. They'd been given to the European Union because, you know, they needed to be exercised at the highest possible level to police a single market, ergo they should come back to London. The devolved position, which unfortunately won out in the original parliamentary debates because Theresa May lost her majority, is that because a lot of these powers fell in areas of policy that had evolved, they should be devolved. And so that set up a huge battle, and I think a very sort of existentially important battle, between Westminster and the devolved administrations over who is ultimately in charge of vast areas of the UK common market. That's what's led to the UK Internal Market Act, which I think constitutionally is one of, if not the most important pieces of legislation we've seen in a long time, which reasserted Westminster's right to govern the single market and to overrule the devolved administrations. And we're going to see an awful lot more of this, because the question is, you know, the European Union baked in a lot of ways a certain way, relationship between Westminster, Brussels and the devolved administrations. And now we've lost Brussels, there's going to be a big bun fight over how the new balance of power is within the United Kingdom.
And Arlene, what's your take on, is the best way to actually keep the UK together counterintuitively to go for a lot more devolution. I mean, the UK is still an incredibly centralised country in terms of where the major sort of tax and spend decisions are made. You know, the vast bulk of those are still made at a Westminster level. Would you like to see the Northern Ireland Assembly having much greater powers on what the corporation tax rate is in Northern Ireland, what the income tax rate is on Northern Ireland, what the regulatory regime is in Northern Ireland? Or has it been that devolution that's sort of begun to lead to the unravelling? The idea, I think, that Tony Blair said was set up the Holyrood Parliament in Scotland and it will kill the Scottish Nationalists stone dead. But in fact, they've benefited from it politically enormously.
Well, I have always believed that tax power should remain at Westminster. That's always been my position. I did, however, and I was persuaded of the corporation tax argument because of the fact that our next door neighbour had corporation tax at 12.5% and were actually using that as a tool to get companies to come into the Republic of Ireland, and therefore we were having to compete in a very uneven way. So there was a campaign about, goodness, about 10 years ago to try and get the corporate taxes devolved. Of course, because of the European ruling on the Azores, if we were to get those tax-raising powers, we were going to have to pay that out of our block grant. So it was going to be hugely expensive for us in Northern Ireland. But actually, we do have those powers devolved now, but we've never used them, because of the fact that it, obviously COVID came along after devolution came back into Northern Ireland, and then there hasn't been a move along on that. But look, I do, as a first principle, believe that tax power should remain at Westminster. That's something I've always believed in, and I haven't varied from that.
Henry, I saw you shaking your head when I said, you know, kind of a federal solution is the best way to go. No, you don't think so?
No, absolutely. Well, because we've already seen it, right? The problem is that when you have devolution of the sort we have at the moment, you end up breaking up the UK as a coherent polity, because fewer and fewer areas of life we're governed as the British. And that means our sense of being British starts to diminish. And if that continues too far down the road, then eventually people will stop feeling British. They'll stop backing fiscal transfers. Yeah. And, you know, if there's no British people, there's no British Treasury and no British cash. So ultimately, and the other problem, I think, is that the devolution we currently have has not actually been all that localist. If you look at what's happened in Wales and what's happened in Scotland, it's led to these extremely centralising administrations in Edinburgh and in Cardiff, which have undermined local power all over the place. So I think that a more decentralised United Kingdom with more powers to Aberdeen, more powers to North Wales, yes, that's a very viable solution. But the idea that is that giving more and more sort of powers that are essential to the proper functioning of the British state and economy to local elites, at least half of whom don't want this country to keep functioning and existing, it seems to me to be self-evidently self-defeating.
Okay, I reckon we've pretty much cracked the Northern Ireland problem. So, and I knew we would, but I want to move on to something which is actually associated to it in this next section. I want to talk about what we're calling supply chain schadenfreude. The EU, well, some elements of the EU seem to be patting themselves on the back a bit, and perhaps some of the continuity Remainer lobby in the UK. But as far as supply chains are concerned, now I appreciate the Northern Ireland Protocol is exacerbating or even being the main cause of these problems, but we do seem to have a substantial underlying problem here, and warnings that, you know, you might not be able to get everything that you want for Christmas. Arlene, what do you think is behind all of this? What's going wrong? It seems to me to be a worldwide problem.
Oh, it is.
40% of German businesses say they're losing sales because of supply shortages. I understand Americans can't get their turkeys for Thanksgiving. You would think that's pretty much the end of civilization in America. Yeah, yeah. What's the underlying problem here?
I mean, there is an underlying problem. And I mean, I was really taken. I saw that story about America today on Fox News. I think it was something along the lines of, you know, what is causing this problem? And I thought, well, it's certainly not Brexit, which is what we're always charged with here in the UK in relation to HGV drivers. I mean, the problem with HGV drivers was there long before Brexit. I mean, when I was economy minister in Northern Ireland, people were saying to me, we can't get people to come forward, the training's too expensive, it takes too long to get your HGV licence. And then, of course, the culture and way of life is very challenging as well, particularly with all the EU regulations that were piled on the top of them. So we do have to sort that issue out. We also have to sort out the global shipping issue, which is there as well, which is a sort of a knock-on effect, if you like, from that blockage that happened. And you wouldn't believe it's taken this long to have that. But I mean, don't forget that when you have those global shipping lanes, you have those big vessels on the seas for months and months at end. And then when they try to get in and they can't get in the normal way, then there's a problem.
Henry, quickly to you, what's the underlying problem? Is this just perhaps a COVID backlog? If you were to look at HGV drivers, I mean, I'm not an expert in that sector, but I'm presuming we sort of just didn't process any really over the last 18 months. And so, you know, if we can get the wheels turning again on that and other things that are ground to a halt, is it just a backwash of that, or is something more fundamental going on?
I mean, it seems to be, I mean, to at least to an extent. I think I read somewhere that we have 50,000 unprocessed HGV driver applications and a shortage of 90,000. So it sounds like if we could get the DVLA back up and running, then it could take a significant chunk out of the problem. But I think ultimately this is just sort of the downside of living in what's normally a great upside, which is a very interconnected, globalised world. You know, the fact that we have all of these global supply chains that often get things in just in time and are run like clockwork, which gathers all these goods and services at the click of a finger. When something does go wrong, such systems like that are fragile, and when something goes wrong, we all feel it.
It was a shock to the system. Okay, well, as I said at the beginning of tonight's show, today is the 50th episode of Live with Littlewood. That nearly a quarter of a million people have watched the show so far, so thanks to all of you who have. Here's to many more episodes to come, and here's a short clip of some of our episodes in weeks and months past. Welcome to this, the first episode of Live with Littlewood, with me, Mark Littlewood, the Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs. And joining me this evening is a stellar cast of free market thinkers, journalists, liberal economists, who are going to set the world to right in the next hour and a quarter or so. Kaboom, we're back. Good evening, good evening, good evening. It's 6 o'clock on Wednesday, the 29th of July. A beautiful, albeit very quiet evening here in Westminster. We're kaboom, kapow, welcome, welcome, welcome. Merry Christmas season greetings. Happy holidays, whatever it is you're supposed to say at this time of the year. Thanks for joining me, Mark Littlewood, Director General of the IEA. Kapow, kaboom, good evening, good evening, good evening. Welcome, welcome, welcome. After a week off for good behaviour, Live with Littlewood is back with a bang. Kaboom, kapow, welcome, welcome, welcome back to Live with Littlewood, the new look Live with Littlewood. Now, in our studio here, we have a live studio audience. We've got a lot to get through. So we put Northern Ireland to rights, and I think, you know, we can pretty easily solve these supply chain problems before too long. But a few more problems in the world to solve, and to help navigate that through, please welcome my third guest, the IEA's very own Victoria Hewson, our Head of Regulatory Affairs. Hi, Victoria. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Lovely to have you with us. Now, Victoria, before I move on to our next topic, you're also our kind of Northern Ireland protocol trade expert, all-round expert on all things legal here at the IEA. So I want your take, and I'll ask Henry and Arlene as well. Here's my radical solution to the problem.
Here we go.
We invite, on the table, you know, you can say yes at any time, the Republic of Ireland to rejoin the UK single market. Problem solved, isn't it? They joined the common market with us because we were such close trade partners. Why not put that offer on the table now?
You could certainly offer a way. I suspect the answer might be rather blunt from the Irish government on that. I mean, there is certainly a logic to it, but I think it's not really a viable suggestion, and I suspect actually even making the suggestion would be rather inflammatory, and so probably better that Lord Frost doesn't make
it. Why would it be so inflammatory? I'm not insisting they rejoin the single market, I'm just putting an option on the table for them. What's wrong with that?
Well, I'm sure Henry and Arlene are probably better qualified than I am to talk about the cultural implications of that. I think probably the Irish government would claim that they worked hard enough and long enough to free themselves from being part of the UK single market that they don't really have any appetite to rejoin us. And of course, as Henry was just alluding to, one critical point about a single market, whether that's the UK single market or the EU single market, is that you do need to have a centralised authority to oversee it. And I think there would be very little appetite in Dublin to submit to that centralised authority out of Westminster again.
Arlene, I'm accepting that the chances of the Republic government saying yes to my generous proposal are pretty thin, but it seems to me, logically and rationally, that should at least be on the table.
Well, I don't think you're giving them a sense of themselves. That's the problem, as we would be told on many occasions in negotiations with Republicans and Nationalists. Look, I mean, the reality is, actually, the Republic of Ireland does a hell of a lot of trade with the UK. It's a really big partner for them. And that's why there was this existential shock to the Republic of Ireland when the UK voted to leave the EU. Mm-hmm. They have always worked so closely together in the EU. They're very much see the UK as a very important destination for their goods. They're not going to rejoin the UK single market because from a constitutional point of view, they would see that as an anathema. So let's deal with that. But I think it's a very generous offer that you're making all the same.
Henry, do you think my generous offer will go down well in Dublin?
I mean, my Castle Catholic ancestors would be delighted at Operation Prodigal Son. I think that the usefulness of the offer is not that they'll accept it, but that it illustrates why the economic arrangements for Northern Ireland matter so much. Mm. Because you have, throughout the process of leaving the European Union, you had a certain class of commentator, and you know, European commentator, who was saying, this has nothing to do with Northern Ireland's Britishness. It has nothing to do with Northern Ireland's place in the United Kingdom. It's just the single market. And I think the usefulness of your proposal is that you turn it around and you go, this has nothing to do with Ireland's sense of Irishness. Mm-hmm. It's just accepting British economic hegemony. Mm-hmm. And they react the way they will inevitably react. And then you can go, right, well, that's how we feel about having part of our country carved off and kept in the single market. Let's please drop the subject.
Okay, well, I'm going to keep working on this. I mean, I accept, Victoria, your diplomatic view that, you know, the time might not be right, but I want to keep this bubbling. I want to keep this bubbling under.
It's also, Mark, I mean, if you listen to some of the commentators and some of the TDs, actually, in other words, MPs in the Republic, when it was talked about the fact that we were under the ECJ, they said that was a theoretical issue. Mm. A theoretical issue. I mean, it's not a theoretical issue. They are actually the final arbiter.
If it's so trivial and theoretical, correct, why do they have such an issue about removing it from Northern Ireland?
Ask them how they'd feel about having the House of Lords be their final court of appeal.
Well, that's...
And again, you know.
But it's only theoretical.
Privy Council.
Absolutely.
But am I right? Is my history correct that a large part of the logic of the Republic of Ireland joining the common market at the same time as we did was that the two economies were so much in lockstep, and therefore if the UK was going to join the common market back in 1972, was it, that the Republic had to follow suit?
They are less so now, like an awful lot of countries. You know, the European Britain's membership of the European Union means that we've disaligned, although a lot of those economies have disaligned with us. But yes, it's still then especially, but even now to an extent, there is a huge amount of trade between the Republic of Ireland and the United Kingdom. And some kind of economic union, if you took all the politics and the identity out of it, some kind of economic union on these islands probably would make rational sense, but you can't disentangle economics from identity. I think that's what we've learned throughout the Brexit process.
Right. Well, listen, ladies and gent, I mean, I think we've done a pretty good job of cracking two big problems in half an hour, so I'm sure you can crack the third one with me as well. The apparent energy crisis at the moment, again, what's going on? The energy woes seem to be worsening by the day, almost. We're going to, I think, see prices rise and rise. Victoria, what's gone wrong here on energy and what's going to put it right? There you go. Two easy underarm questions for you to crack.
Well, I think I suppose we could pinpoint one overriding issue with our energy markets at the moment, and that is massive, excessive state intervention from all angles. And I think it was Professor Dieter Helm, the great energy expert who's written a lot on this, made the point that there is so much energy regulation that nobody in the industry, nobody in government could possibly understand all of it and understand how it all fits together. And that in itself is a drag on efficiency. And then you have the effect, or the actual substantive effect, of all of these energy policies, the subsidies that have driven particular technologies, namely especially renewables like wind and solar, and our vulnerability as a result of that has very much been shown up in these past weeks due to seasonal factors. The wind stopped blowing, that introduces great instability in the grid and a reliance on old-fashioned gas power stations, which means what? We need more gas, which means, of course, you know, the price of gas goes up, and there's all of those knock-on effects across the whole supply chain, and it also becomes pretty geopolitical. You know, who is supplying this gas and how? Is it coming from pipelines from Russia? Is it coming on container ships in liquid form? And is it being caught up in all of those supply chain issues you were just talking about? And I'm afraid the underlying problem is that the government has tried to control this for decades now, really. Our free market in energy was pretty short-lived before it started being chipped away at again, especially for green reasons. And unfortunately, it turns out that the government hasn't really been very good at trying to centrally plan and control it all.
Arlene, do you think this has been a problem that has just been, it's been building up for some considerable time? There's been all sorts of interventions in the energy market, and then you need a new intervention to try and unravel the failure of the previous intervention, and so it just gets worse and worse and worse. The National Audit Office, looking back to when we basically privatised the energy sector, the early results were pretty good. The average saving for domestic consumers immediately post-privatisation was 20% for gas, 10% for electricity. But as Victoria says, we've then sort of, although the it's still in private hands, we've got so much regulation and intervention that you could almost say it's been kind of renationalised through regulatory fiat, basically.
Yeah, and of course, we're told that we need those regulations to protect the consumer. And it's actually the consumer that's been hit by those regulations. Mm-hmm. So when you have energy policy, there's a three-legged part to it. So you have the security of supply, you have the cost of it to the consumer, and then you have the mix. And because of the decisions that we've taken on the mix of our energy, we're then impacting on the security of supply and the cost, those other two elements. So they're all interrelated, if you like. And as I understand it, we only have 50% of our own gas supplies. We get about 30% from Norway and then 20% from the rest of the world. So that's Russia, if you like. And you might say, well, that's only 20%. But actually, because everything's just in time in terms of the energy market, it actually does have an impact. And the question I have is, why haven't we been doing more on storage in the UK? Actually, today in Northern Ireland, we have just the go-ahead has been given to a company to store gas off the coast of Northern Ireland in salt caverns. And I think that's quite an exciting prospect because it will allow us to keep up to 14 days of gas supply off the coast. And that's really good. But we need to see more storage happening. And then, of course, we don't like to talk about nuclear, but we should be talking about nuclear. And people get very worried when you mention the word nuclear. But my goodness, if we're going to innovate and if we're going to move forward, then we need to be looking at nuclear. It is zero carbon. And it is actually something that is really clean. So why aren't we doing more talking about it?
So I've already come up with the solution to the problem of the UK single market. And I'm glad you mentioned nuclear. I reckon we can crack energy prices and CO2 emissions by going for nuclear and for fracking. We've abandoned shale gas, right? I mean, we're not just looking a gift horse in the mouth, we're punching a gift horse in the mouth.
Well, if you look at the price of gas in America compared with here in the UK, there's a huge difference. And why is that? Because of shale gas.
Henry, what's your take on the energy market? We've broken it, we've picked away at it, chiselled away at it. It's not surprising it's broken. How on earth do we get it back on track and get energy prices down? And we've got this carbon net zero target by 2050 hanging over us.
Well, I think the entire panel agrees that basically the state has intervened lots where it probably shouldn't have. And in places where you could maybe have used the state, things like having a national nuclear policy, building the national gas reserve, they just haven't done it. Mm. But the problem is actually, nuclear, I'm a huge fan of nuclear power. We should obviously do it, try to do it. But the challenge with nuclear is that, because we haven't been building nuclear power stations for so long, and really nor has the West in general, the expertise really isn't there. It's a bit like with our nuclear power, with our nuclear submarines. Now we've learned our lesson and we build one about every 18 months. But previously, we built a fleet of nuclear submarines and then just left it because we didn't need any more. Mm-hmm. And as a result, that technology, that industry in Barrow vanished, and it took a long time to rebuild. It's the same problem with nuclear power. There simply isn't a British domestic nuclear industry that's ready to build a nuclear power programme, even if the political will was there. Mm-hmm. So the question is, one, do you go to the Chinese and get them to build your essential infrastructure? Probably not. Two, you then need to invest an awful lot of time and money in reshoring that capacity, and that's going to take time. So in the short term, you're really left with no option but to try and buy stuff up, have a more geopolitically secure balance of imports. Mm. And yes, I think in the long term, you absolutely want to be investing into developing a nuclear industry, because that could also be an export. If we genuinely built up expertise in that, we could then go to lots of other countries that are trying to be green without sacrificing economic growth, and that could be a real source of soft power. But you do need to make a big long-term investment in building up that industry, and that requires more vision than most British governments.
That's ridiculous. What about on shale? You know, we decided to abandon that because NIMBY said there might be a bit too, you know, the traffic might be a bit noisy.
Yeah, absolutely. In theory, shale is great, but a British government that's prepared to exploit shale is a British government that's prepared to build houses. It would be wonderful, but it doesn't exist.
So, Victoria, this is pretty disappointing. No houses, no shale, and even if we wanted nuclear, we can't build it properly anyway.
Well, it is very disappointing. I don't...
It doesn't matter that there's no food on the shelves, because there's going to be no energy to cook the food.
Well, and I think that, you know, that brings us into the question of, are we heading for some really hard times, a sort of cost of living crisis? Mm. I guess, you know, I think we can probably discount the petrol panic that we saw as being an artificial creation of some rumours that were set out in the media, potentially, I would say, by some rather opportunistic businesses who saw an opportunity to push a particular line that they had in mind in terms of immigration and more visas for HGV drivers. But that, you know, I think we can put that to one side. The real crisis is going to be when people's gas bills come in the winter and the spring, when the price cap goes next spring, and all of the knock-on effects from that, because everything we consume has an energy cost baked into it. And then, you know, then are we into inflationary effects and things that are really going to bite on top of the more structural issues Henry was alluding to about house prices and, you know, the possibility for young families, especially in the south and southeast of England, to own their own home becomes even more out of reach.
This is all very bleak, Henry. Just before I let you go, what are we in for here? We're all going to be cold and face higher prices on what's left of things on our supermarket shelves. This isn't a very attractive winter, is it?
No, I mean, good Lord, no. And then the short to medium term, the prospect for young people is even worse. You know, we're probably looking at something resembling Japanification if we can't start building houses and getting people into them. So you know, lots of people I speak to in their 20s and 30s whose careers allow it are looking at, you know, futures abroad. It's not a happy prospect at the moment.
Okay, well, I'm going to... Henry, thank you very much for joining us. Arlene and Victoria, stay with us. We've only got 20 minutes left. I'm going to have to cheer some people up in the last 20 minutes or so. But before we get to the last section of the show, I was at Conservative Conference last week. The IEA organised its usual think tent marquee with loads of events on a vast range of different topics. They're coming up on our IEA London YouTube channel, so look at the videos below and you can watch them. But one of the highlights was I was pretty determined in half an hour or so to try and fix the entire UK economy, and I had the opportunity to put my ideas about how we should do that to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak. The short clip's coming up now. You touched on this a little, but I want to probe it further in the first half of the match, and that was economic growth, right? So we've, very rough terms, since the financial crisis of 2008, I'm not making a sort of partisan point at all but growth rates, there or thereabouts, 1.5% per annum, right, there or thereabouts, and historically 2.5%, 3% per annum. What do you put the very disappointing growth rates over the last 12, 13, 14 years down to?
Yeah, look, no one knows, right? No one has.
I do.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Go on.
Very heavily taxed, ever more regulated economy.
What about all the other countries that have experienced exactly the same thing?
Well, they're also heavily...
When there was no change in their tax burden
the West, essentially, I mean, there's not much difference between ourselves and the other EU countries. The fast-growing countries have, as I was saying, closer to 20%. So, I mean, that was... Thanks so much.
Great.
Thanks
that
so
was
much.
Really good. Really, really good.
Excellent. So the full interview with Rishi Sunak, that's available to view on our YouTube channel, so check that out. I think I gave him a fair but hard time. And for our final guest on this evening's show, delighted to be joined by actually an ex-politician, a recovering politician of a very different kind, our former academic and research director here at the IEA and previously the leader of the New Zealand ACT Party. Please welcome writer and economist Jamie White. Good to have you with us. Lovely to see you. I should start on the ACT Party of New Zealand, actually. It's It's done brilliantly since you left, hasn't it?
It has indeed. But that's not the story.
Right.
So my successor is a chap called David Seymour, who is a way better politician than me. We have a three-year electoral cycle in New Zealand. And the next election, so I achieved for the party the great result of 0.71% of the vote. And at the next election, David Seymour achieved 0.53% of the vote, which wasn't great. And he was bewildered. But then, because he thought, he had done a good job, I thought, but I thought I'd done a good job.
But well, then you did. You were 0.18% better than his job.
But then he got, at this last election, he got 8% of the vote, which is actually the highest that ACT's ever got, and they have 9 MPs. And now they're polling, they've polled as high as 16% recently.
Yes, sir.
And I think the reason is that they're really the opposition now. The National Party is in disarray, and they went along with almost everything Jacinda Ardern has been doing. Mm. And they have no kind of principled basis with which to argue against her, just like the Tories wouldn't now if there were a Labour government. Mm. And ACT has been the principled opposition, and so people who disagree with Jacinda Ardern are rallying around ACT.
There you go. Okay. Well, I know in your native homeland, Jamie, there's been quite severe lockdown measures in dealing with the COVID pandemic, but I want to go in this last section of the show, talk about what lessons we might be beginning to learn from an audit of how the United Kingdom carried out its COVID response. Not very well, as you might gather from the title of this last section of the show. We're calling it COVID Catastrophe. The Common Science and Technology Committee report on the COVID response came out yesterday. It was pretty tough on the government, saying the country should have locked down sooner. The government was insufficiently prepared for the pandemic. Jamie, what's your take? I don't know if you've read the report, but on how ill-prepared the UK appeared to be for the pandemic, even though, you know, there were stories about, you know, COVID emerging and what the problems could be. It wasn't completely out of a clear blue sky by last March, right?
Well, I think that the report is correct if you've got a single metric for success, which is preventing COVID deaths. If you are trying to maximise welfare more broadly, so it almost tells you nothing because they don't even consider that, just like the government hasn't considered it all along. So if you were trying to minimise COVID deaths, you might rightly say they should have gone into lockdown earlier. But I would rather they had been Swedish and tried to minimise overall harm to society. Mm-hmm. And the answer might have been, in that case, not to lockdown at all. I mean, one or two things that were crazy on any count, right? For example, clearing old people out of NHS beds and sticking them altogether.
A disastrous decision. Yeah.
But that, again, oddly enough, was a mistake made in quite a few places. I think it was all the rhetoric around protecting the NHS that drove that. So that's my view of the whole thing, basically.
Arlene, what's your view? Because, look, part of me says we should have some sympathy for politicians and policymakers in the midst of an unfolding, uncertain crisis. You know, we didn't know how bad the disease was going to be. It took us a while to work out who it was going to affect. It's an ageist, racist and sexist virus, right? Mm. It's men more than women, elderly people more than younger people, ethnic minorities more than white people. So do you think that we shouldn't be surprised? Should we be forgiving that the response was confused? But to give you an example, the initial advice on face masks, which was that they were useless. This was actually banned, used as a rationale to ban advertisements for face masks. That's where we were at. We must ban advertisements. Sure. And then a few months later, lo and behold, they're compulsory. No need to advertise them because you've got to buy one. Should we be sympathetic that there's unfolding difficult circumstances, or has this been an absolute horlicks of a response?
Well, I'm slightly conflicted, Mark, because I was in the position of First Minister of Northern Ireland at the time, so I am conflicted, not slightly conflicted. But, you know, we were being given a advice. We're talking about just in time, originally, just in time advice that so many people were going to die unless we took this decision. Mm-hmm. That's a scary place for any politician to be, because when the inevitable public inquiry comes, and it will, the charge will be, you knew that, you were given that advice, so many people died, you're responsible for those people dying. And I do agree And we tried to do it in Northern Ireland. I tried to do it in Northern Ireland to take a broader look at what this would mean if we locked down. What impact would it have on our businesses? What impact would it have on our young people, our children missing school? Of course, the mental health issues that it was going to cause. And I mean, I have an elderly mother, and she was very isolated by being locked up in her own home. Mm-hmm. And I think it really has had an impact upon her, actually, if I'm fair about it. So I think it's absolutely right. We can't just look at the deaths of people from COVID in terms of looking back. We need to look at the whole issue and what impact did it have on society at that time. And I hope that when the public inquiry does come, that it does do that.
Victoria, you've been a very consistent lockdown sceptic. You know, I know you've had a few punch-ups with some of your IA colleagues that we've been too wet and drippy and sympathetic to the politicians. Do you think one of the real problems here is the one that Arlene was just touching on? It's the great French philosopher and economist Frédéric Bastiat, who said the difference between the seen and the unseen. So you could see very clearly, I mean, you know, and it was being reported day on day, you know, how many people infected, yeah. What's the R rate to a decimal point, how many people have died today? What we didn't see, but is just as, you know, perhaps even worse, is the back catalogue on breast cancer, for example. Yeah. I think I'm right in saying that this could lead to 100,000 excess deaths because cancer treatment and screening wasn't in place. Is it that problem that the scene, politicians like Arlene were in a kind of, right, you've got to make a decision in 5 minutes, and this is the top item on the 6 o'clock news. But actually, had we been able to stand back and breathe, we may have done more harm than we've prevented.
Right, I think that's completely right. And I think the media focus on COVID numbers constantly, and the daily press conferences, I don't think helped with that decision making at all. And of course, the questions from the media at the press conferences was always, why isn't the government doing more? Why aren't you locking down sooner? Why aren't you being even stricter? There was never any question about, have you considered the long-term scarring effects of keeping children out of school for years at a time? And, you know, the losses to children's education and welfare, I just can't even bear to think of it. The other remarkable thing, actually, I thought about this report was where it was accusing scientists, the government scientific advisers, of falling prey to groupthink that made them too slow to follow China and lock down. Well, I'm sorry, I'm quite in favour of groupthink that favours keeping people out of house arrest and allowing society to feature to continue in a relatively normal way. I would consider that to be groupthink in favour of living in a free society, and I'd quite like to get a bit more of that.
The kind of group you want to be a part of, basically.
I quite like that kind of groupthink.
Can I add something? Jamie. When you asked me if they were appallingly ill-prepared, they weren't completely ill-prepared. I mean, there had been plans made for what to do if there were a pandemic like this, and amongst those plans was the idea, apparently completely orthodox idea, that you should never have compulsory quarantining of healthy people. That this was a crazy idea and it should never be done. That consensus view of the medical profession was overturned, not on the basis of any revised work or theory, just political panic.
Yeah.
I wish they'd stuck to their plans, to their preparations. They were prepared and they didn't follow their preparations.
Well, it's interesting you say they were prepared, Jamie. Our very own Christopher Snowden would take you to task on that.
He's one of those wets.
In Victoria, but lots of people are wet compared to Victoria. Let's just get this right, OK? But he was of the view, and do you think this is a fair charge, that actually our public health authorities have not been dealing with public health matters, they've been dealing with private health matters. So were you to look at Public Health England, the impression, I can't break down their entire budget, but observing their media profile, was, you know, a major priority for the nation is to ban advertisements for jam and to make sure that there aren't McDonald's adverts on the London Underground or whatever. These are the great public health issues of our times. And I think I'm channeling Chris Snowden to say, you know, you had one job, and it is to present, you know, don't get into the fields of jam advertising and fast food. Just prepare for a possible pandemic.
Well, I absolutely agree that they shouldn't have been getting involved in, you know, jam ads. The reason they do, by the way, is a slippage in the use of the term public good or public
health.
Public doesn't mean something that affects the public. It means something very specific in economics about mechanisms by which costs are transferred to people. mainly that they don't voluntarily take them on, right? That's what it means. Nowadays, people talk about public services, like education is a public service. Well, yes, it's, in some sense it is, because it's a service for the public. But then again, so is what supermarkets do, a public service. It's a service for the public. So this blurring of this notion of what public means has been kind of across the board, and it's had a ridiculous effect here, where the government starts getting involved in entirely personal choices. And of course, now we have an agency dedicated to that. I mean, yeah.
They've split them now, haven't they, into two new agencies, one which is going to be what you and I would call public health, you know, general public health and emergency, like the poisoning of the water supply or another pandemic. It's, and the other is to tell me what I need to do to get back into my old suits and
one of them
lose
is justified.
A stone of weight, right?
One of them's an organisation that could be justified and the other isn't.
Arlene, do you think that we dropped the ball on this by not being sufficiently focused? That our public health agencies should be on these, you know, universal potential attacks, whether it's a virus coming in or, you know, I guess we need to prepare for a cybersecurity attack or something like that. And their eye was on things, which, as Jamie said, maybe health matters for members of the public, but are essentially private decisions, you know, whether you eat too much or food's too sugary or what advertisements you watch.
Well, I do think there was an amount of panic that set in at that time. And, I mean, we've already heard that there were plans in place and we weren't going to go into a quarantine situation because that would be just unacceptable and it wasn't the right thing to do, but that was overturned. Because people got into a panic situation. And we got into a situation, and as politicians, this is a very difficult issue because we're standing in front of a camera, and you're absolutely right, Victoria. You're hit with the questions of, but you should have acted quicker. X number of people died yesterday, and do you feel responsible for those people dying? But there was no figures on how many people had died from late cancer diagnosis or the fact that they couldn't get into the hospital for their stroke appointment or anything. There was no comparative figures around any of that. So it was, and I mean, I'm not looking for sympathy here, but it was difficult for the politicians at that time because they were bombarded with COVID. COVID became the only thing that people were talking about at that particular point in time. And if you tried, as I did, to bring a bit of balance into the situation, then you were absolutely lambasted because we tried to not close down, I think it was October, November 2020, and that we give more space. And the newspapers and the broadcast media went absolutely boogaloo.
I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, I want to finish off by kind of blaming the media, right? I
mean, excellent news.
So, look, I believe in a free press and you know, the press can ask you, you know, any questions they want and a Downing Street briefing can ask any questions they want. But, my God, it was one note, all of the questions. Yeah. I can't think of a single journalist who said, OK, you know, you've now had seven questions from the BBC and Sky. I'm from a different outlet. I want to ask you, how bad do you think the economic hit's going to be and what you think the consequences of that economic hit's going to be on the health of the British public over the course of the next 2 years? Never, not once at any press conference did I hear that from a single journalist.
And if you tried to bring that into the conversation, people said, oh, you prefer to make wealth and protect people's health. And you're going, sorry, that is completely wrong. Because if you don't have economic well-being, then you are going to suffer in terms of your health as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this was this sort of false narrative that grew up between health and wealth.
I'm afraid you're a granny killer.
Mm. Yeah, that was what it was described. Yeah, it was. But Jamie, why didn't you? I mean, Victoria was saying that she doesn't mind groupthink as long as the groupthink's in favour of a kind of free and open society. But was there groupthink in the cross examination here? I mean, I wanted to hear 10 very different questions from 10 very different journalists approaching the problem from very different angles. And in fact, all I really heard from this supposedly diverse and competitive media was a groupthink echo chamber.
The mainstream media was astonishing how what you say is completely true, and I think the reason for that, groupthink's one of these terms that's thrown around nowadays. I think that what explains it is that the people who get into those roles get there by being a certain way, and they're all roughly the same, and they come from similar backgrounds, and they talk in similar ways, and if they didn't talk in those ways, they wouldn't get that job, and so there's a kind of a unsurprising uniformity in it, and the one of the problems with this is, of course, that a lot of people note it, they get frustrated, and they go out of the mainstream media, and then where the gatekeeper functions weaker, And they start reading a lot of cranks and going a little crazy. Some friends of mine have gone completely crazy during COVID. Right? I mean, I've gone a little bit crazy. They've gone completely mad.
What, sort of full-blown conspiracy?
Friends of mine, yeah, who are intelligent people, have so violently reacted against what's been going on, but the kind of enforced view, that they've gone off the deep end.
I have a friend similar who... started with COVID skepticism, ended up in that famous YouTube cycle, and ended up saying to me the other night, Victoria, you know, I really don't think jet fuel can melt steel beams.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
But some of it, I'm doing this from memory, so I might have got this wrong by a whisker. One of my concerns about public information was there was one opinion poll, it must have been, I think, in the summer of 2020, there or thereabouts, and I can't remember which polling company commissioned it. But it asked the great British public, Arlene, what proportion of the British population do you believe have now died of COVID-19? And the kind of mean median guess was that about 9% of the population had died, 5 million people. I mean, how anybody could reach that conclusion is beyond me, and especially as at this time people were tuning into news like never before. Statistics were being put to you on an hourly basis, and yet the kind of average guess was that 5 million people had died. It seems to me, on any analysis, whether that's a government public information function or whether that's the job of our media, people were scared for sure, but it seems a good number of them were scared based on facts that were woefully inadequate, that their beliefs were that this was on a scale that it wasn't. Now, I'm not saying just because it was lower than that we shouldn't have done anything, but if the average person thought that 5 million people had already died, well, you can understand why that might change their views about what should be done.
And people were really afraid, let's be very clear about all of that. And I remember at the very start of all of this, we were preparing temporary morgues and we were being told that so many of our population was going to die. And that really fed into the narrative that then became, you know, we need to take action and we need to do X, Y, and Z. So look, at the start, people hadn't a clue what was going on and they did take action consequential on that. But I do think that when we look at the public inquiry, which will come, people can't engage in hindsight, Captain Hindsight routines. They have to actually look at what happened at that particular point in time and why we took the decisions we took.
So let me just finish by asking each of you whether you think, and Arlene, I'll start with you, are we going to learn some meaningful lessons from the public inquiry about how better to prepare, about what sort of, do we need more resilient institutions, you know, how does science interface with politics? Which policies worked? I mean, virtually every country in the world's had to deal with this in some way. As long as you can put it all in an Excel spreadsheet, we should be able to work out which policies worked and which didn't. Or do you think it's just going to be a finger-pointing exercise and everybody's going to try and pin as much of the blame as possible on Matt Hancock and hope that they don't have the finger-pointing at them?
Well, look, I mean, if it's going to be a finger-pointing exercise, you could write the script now. But what I hope it is... really what I hope it is a holistic public inquiry that doesn't just look at the government actors, but actually does look at the media and the role that they played in what actually happened in society at that particular point in time.
Victoria, what do you think we're going to get from the formal public inquiry? But obviously this is going to be, looking back on this, is going to be a topic for considerable general debate and books will be written and all of the rest of it. What are we going to learn, if anything?
So I suspect rather than finger pointing, it might be more of an exercise in obfuscation. And to the extent that lessons will be learned, my fear is that it will be all the wrong lessons that will take us in all the wrong directions. So that for me, you know, the underlying question should be, how do we make sure we never do a lockdown exercise again? I doubt if that will be the premise that they will come from.
Jamie, what do you think we're going to learn, if anything?
Well, I saw a chap, over some Twitter link. He was being filmed, he was an important person. He was saying that if you think the management of COVID has been a fiasco from a health point of view, well, you ain't seen nothing yet because of climate change. Now, so there's an agenda here where people say if something affects health, nothing else matters.
Yes.
You can put 100% into it. And I fear that this idea is catching on now and that it'll be, if it's a premise of this inquiry, this then, as Victoria says, it's going to lead to all the wrong conclusions.
And do you think that the only thing that we might get out of this, Jamie, is that even if we were to learn some lessons, it will be lessons on how to fight the last war. We will be utterly resilient against any coronavirus that escapes from a bat cave in China, but very likely the next problem to hit us will be something completely different. And yeah. around that, you need kind of resilient institutions rather than just how would I rerun this exercise, because that precise chain of events is unlikely to happen again, right?
Yeah, and one thing to bear in mind is that there are lots of institutions that aren't the government. And so resilient institutions doesn't always mean centralising all decision-making. You know, you mentioned the hidden and the seen and the unseen. Well, it's what's seen by the central government, yes, that's unseen, but you know, the misery that individuals are suffering is seen by them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
if you disperse, if you decision-making, you minimise the problem of the unseen because it is seen.
Sure. Well, listen, I promised at the outset of the show that we would put the world to rights, we'd solve the Northern Ireland Protocol problem, we'd solve the supply chain problems, the energy crisis, and make sure we're better prepared for any future pandemic or national emergency, and I promised to solve it in an hour. I lied. We solved it in 1 hour, 4 minutes and 37 seconds, so not bad. A little bit of an overrun, but I think we've done a pretty good job. My stellar panel of guests have done a pretty good job of putting the world to rights. So Arlene, Jamie, Victoria, thank you very much for joining me on this 50th half-century episode of Live with Leatherwood. My thanks too to Henry, who joined us earlier. Thanks to everybody at home for watching. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Once again, hit the like button, hit subscribe, hit the notification bell to make sure that you don't miss an episode. If you are willing to support us, please do become an IEA online patron and do that if you'd like to secure yourself a place in our audience, live audience in the future. And huge thanks to those who've become top tier patrons: Donald Blaney, Eric Keane, James Burns, Mark Edwards, Philip Ozouf, Richard Leader, Robert Appleby, Timothy Worrell, Costa Manis. Stay safe, stay free. Over and out.